Was it easy being in a band with Pete Burns? I mean, if you've seen any of those reality shows he was on, I don't know how much of that was just him playing up to the camera, but he is definitely an over-the-top personality that I could see...
He wore an eye patch.
Knowing, so take off your chains.
On my neighborhood lot, I found a hearse I could buy. But when I pull out my loot, you should have heard that guy cry.
There ain't nothing worse than a hearse.
What's up, all you anthropomorphic jack-o'-lanterns?
I don't know.
It's all right.
Welcome to Punk Lotto Pod, the game where no one wins. Unless you agree to the devil's contract. I don't know. I wanted to try some different stuff this week.
What's up, pumpkin heads?
I almost said that. But then I was like, is that offensive to somebody? Maybe. People with pumpkins for heads. My name is Justin, who ate all my candy corn, Hensley.
Oh, I don't have one.
Make one up.
Well, let me think about it.
This is all staying in.
I'm going to take my time. I got nothing. I'm all Halloweened out.
And it's only the 18th.
I don't know. I'm blank. I got nothing.
Evil Dylan Hensley. All right. Well, we can tell what kind of this show this one's going to be. This is the show where using the Rate Your Music Punk charts, we choose one album and one EP at random to discuss. This is the final installment of our yearly Halloween Spooktacular, where we only talk about horror punk, death rock, psychobilly, and gothic rock. 5 weeks is too many. We shouldn't have done it this long. We are flying solo again this week because we couldn't trick anyone else into doing a gimmick episode.
Nope. I don't know how we tricked ourselves into it.
We got the trick and the trick-or-treat. Good lord. Please, this is gonna be our worst one.
You're gonna have to edit a lot.
Yeah. So normally we like to look at the charts for the year we've drawn for our episode, but since we're only doing the previously mentioned genres, we didn't quite do that. So we'll just dive right into the album, unless you got something else you want to say.
Nope, not really. Nope.
All right, let's get this turd on the road. So for this episode, we got number 285 on the arbitrary number chart. For our album, it is Play Dead, The First Flower.
A nation seems to wait, but our solutions came too late. The sun had set too fast. Forgotten lessons from the past, but no one seemed to care. Disillusion everywhere. The last dance begins as man commits the final sin. But we dance, dance, dance to the fool's delight.
Some basics out of the way. Play Dead were a goth rock post-punk band from Oxford, England. Or should I do a terrible English accent?
No, you shouldn't.
Oxford, England.
He did it anyway.
They formed in 1980 out of the fading British punk scene, which had moved on to post-punk and new wave by this point. This was released on Jungle Records in 1983, and somehow we've managed to cover albums from the same years multiple times this month. We did three from 1985, and we've done two from 1983 now.
I mean, good years for, yeah, that kind of music.
I guess. I mean,
The 80s was, it was just full of that gothy, scary, dark music. I don't know.
Metal
kind of. I don't know why, but.
Metal kind of became a thing, really, in the 80s. Hardcore was in the 80s. Horror movies, like, really blew up in the 80s, like, mainstream-wise.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. It's almost as if the Reagan administration was terrible.
Well, and Thatcher, too.
I mean, yeah.
Because so much of it was British.
That's true.
It was just a gloomy time.
Yeah. Jungle Records also released albums by Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, The Addicts, UK Subs, every time, Christian Death, Fields of Nephilim, is that how you say that name?
Nephilim?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Neapolitan, and 66 Sputnik, who anytime I see their name, all I think of is High Fidelity.
You guys slam into Joni Mitchell now?
They've also released a ton of other records, but those are the most prominent ones. This was originally released as a 6-track album and was reissued later with 6 more tracks. For the sake of this discussion, the first six tracks are primarily what we will talk about. The rest of the tracks all seem to be like B-sides and extended mixes and earlier recordings. So for the sake of the album, it's really just the first 6 songs. Personnel on this record was Rob Hixon on vocals, Pete Waddleton on bass, Steve Green on guitar, and Mark Whiff Smith on drums. I don't know what Whiff means, but the record was produced by Roy Rowland, who most notably produced albums by Creator, Testament, Sabbat, and Seventh Angel. So, a metal dude.
Yeah.
And this is the most well-known band that all of these members were in, but Mark Smith did do a little percussion work with the Pretenders in the year 2002. He also did some drum tech work for Phil Collins and Genesis, and as well as on the new Mumford & Sons album of all records. So, what did you think of this record?
You know, I sort of liked it, I guess. Like, it's not really remarkable by goth rock standards, 80s post-punk standards. It doesn't do a lot that someone else didn't already do better. I mean, there were some interesting ideas. The playing was pretty good. I thought it was really odd that after the first track, the vocals suddenly sounded like Jello Biafra. Just like for the rest of the album. Like the one song, he just kind of sounds like Ian Curtis or whatever, you know? Just kind of doing a generic monotone post-punk vocal. And then the rest of it, he sounds like Jello Biafra to me.
I thought he sounded like Johnny Rotten. Specifically like his Public Image Limited stuff.
I got a little bit of that too, but yeah. The second song especially, he sounded like Jello. But yeah, probably more like John Lydon.
Which would make
later songs.
Which would make more sense too, being a UK band.
Yeah.
Thank you.
know, I think I liked this album for the most part. And I was thinking about, like, all the albums we've talked about this month. And, I mean, I'm playing a little bit of my hand for the EP we're going to talk about later. But these might be the best pairing that we've had this year for the Halloween records. I mean...
Yeah. I would say this is probably the most consistent between the album and the EPs as far as quality and sound.
Yeah.
These were...
This might be my favorite record we've done this month as well. I'm trying to remember everything we did. We did Necromantics, terrible. Coma was pretty good, nothing amazing. Misfits, awful. A Secret Shame record was good. What did we do with Anne? We did White Zombie. Ugh, hated. And
a mediocre Guanabats record. And...
Yeah, that the lead singer of that band keeps commenting on our posts about.
We're sorry.
Yeah, I'm going to stop putting my opinion on the albums in the Instagram posts. And then, oh yeah, Grave Robber last week with...
Who?
Flesh for Lulu. So, Flesh for Lulu would have fit in perfect with this episode as well.
I think I still liked Flesh for Lulu the most.
Yeah.
Out of everything we talked about this month. But I would put these two pretty high, though. I mean...
Yeah.
This episode, I will... go ahead and say, is probably going to be the highest average score.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree. I also genuinely loved the album cover for this record. It's just some jack-o'-lanterns and, you know, kind of out of focus photo. It's really cool looking, and it fits perfectly with this being the week of Halloween.
You mentioned the album cover, so I actually want to go ahead and talk about it because I found an old interview from probably around 85 or so,
mm-hmm.
Shortly before they broke up, I guess. And they talk about the artwork, and they kind of talk about throughout this interview about how they, like, they didn't really see themselves as a goth band,
mm-hmm.
Which I saw that repeated kind of
yeah.
in other synopses about the band.
And, I saw that too.
Yeah, but they kind of, it seemed like they really didn't like being called a goth band, but they talked about the artwork, and one of the guys in the band, Pete, I believe, had done most of their artwork, but in this interview he says, "What is gothic about the Isabel sleeve? I thought I'd go pre-Raphaelite romantic. Turn of the century English painting, and I said, call that gothic, and they did. On the conspiracy sleeve, I did a Chinese dragon, and I said, call that gothic, and they did. On the propaganda remix, I didn't put anything apart from big lettering, and they called it gothic. On Sacrosanct, I put a stiff on it, as I couldn't be bothered anymore. I put a picture of an Irish castle on the back, and that was gothic. On the live album sleeve, I thought I'd use Mexican Indian embroidery, and they started going on about Aleister Crowley and the reviews, and I thought, what the fuck? But because of all that criticism and or being called, having everything, all of their artwork called gothic, he stopped doing their artwork. So the album sleeve for this was done by Daniel Farrow, I believe was his name, who also did a single cover for Shine, I think. But I just thought that was really funny. Like, everything.
Well,
getting called gothic.
Looking at all of those album covers, they are all kind of gothic. I mean, I know he hates that, but, I mean, it fits their mood and their tone and the music, and I don't know. Maybe the live record is probably the one that doesn't the most, but it's just a map of Europe, but I don't know. It kind of works. I don't know what he's getting so mad about. You're clearly playing goth music, so you should, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if they just...
Maybe.
I don't know. I couldn't find much else about their beef with that classification.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to my ears and the scene that they were a part of, I don't know. The name fits, but...
Do they not hang out with other goth bands, and that may be part of it?
So, and it seems like maybe they wanted... Well, okay. In this interview, they talked a lot about their frustration with their real lack of success.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really they never really had any hits. They never really broke out.
Which surprises me, because the first track on this album should have been a hit, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, it was probably just... They said in this interview, you know, they didn't have the money behind it. They talk about Killing Joke getting a big push behind a single, how the Cult had 40 or 50 grand behind them.
Well, I think it was the labels they were on, too, though.
Yeah.
Who's Jungle Records? I mean, I know who some of those bands are, but they're not the biggest bands of the genre.
Eventually start their own label.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think... See, that's the thing, is this interview is talking about this next album that they're going to do, but there's nothing after First Flower. So, I guess that album didn't actually...
What?
Happen.
After what? First Flower was their first album.
Oh, I'm looking at them backwards. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, then they had...
A bunch of albums.
A couple more, but...
Yeah, I mean, part of it's the label that you're on, part of it's the scene you play in, part of it's just outright the music itself. And I think the main track was... I will say that one of the weakest things about this album is how the sequencing is not very good. It starts with the best tracks and moves to the weakest track, I think. Feel like they probably should have rearranged a couple of these tracks, maybe moved, like, start the album off with the Time, which is the opening track, and then move the second track, The Tenant, to maybe the B-side and have it be the first song on the B-side. They do put Sin of Sins as on the B-side as the first track, and it's a unique song, but it's a weird one because it's got that really funky bass line. And then it has like this weird new wave of British heavy metal guitar element to it. I noticed that on this record, the guitars were a little heavier than a lot of the other goth bands at the time. So yeah, maybe that's part of what they didn't like being called a goth band. It's because they were playing a slightly harder version. Did they think of themselves more along the lines of Killing Joke?
Maybe. I mean, it's hard to say. It'd only be speculation. I really...
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find much else about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sequencing... I would agree, is a little, it's pretty weak. I didn't personally care for The Tenant.
Really?
That much. It's one of the faster songs, but it just, I don't know. It felt like I said, too much like Jello Biafra singing in like a goth band. And it just didn't do much for me. Propaganda, though, and Sin of Sins, I actually really enjoyed. I liked that kind of funky slap bass. It was different, you know?
Yeah. I wasn't really a fan of the bass line. I thought the chorus was really good. Yeah, I didn't really like the weird bass part. Yeah, Propaganda, that was a lead single, I believe, before, or was released as a single before the album came out. Was Time ever actually released as a single? Because that might have been their mistake by not releasing it.
There's the there's Sin of Sins and Propaganda, but no, there's not a single of that song, which was a mistake. It's definitely the best song.
Yeah. Plus, it was a mini album, right? You know, only 6 tracks, and I think they even described it themselves as a mini album. So it's, I feel like the marketing is what failed them.
I was wondering about this, like, why is this classified as an album?
Does it pass the length? I mean, other than it was just pressed on an LP and played at 33?
I mean, it's probably over 25 minutes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Plus, it was probably written as a full album. I don't know that the EP was quite the thing it became later.
Well, no. And we've definitely seen that in terms of our charts.
Yeah.
As far as, and we'll talk about this on our EP for this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I did find myself going past the 6 tracks both times that I listened to this.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up listening to the next couple of songs that are collected on the reissue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any, you know, as lackluster as maybe I'm describing it. It's not something I want to turn off.
No.
By any means. I mean, I very easily kept going, kept listening to the rest, you know, the rest of the songs that are on there. And they're, you know, they include Shine, mm-hmm. which was a single that they released, which was a pretty good song.
Yeah, that was my thinking. I would have included Shine and Gaze on the album.
And I'm curious about, I guess, the timing of when they were written, if they were ready to be recorded yet. I mean, it looks like...
Well, they released them as a single.
Those were released as singles, what, in 84? No, 83.
Yeah.
Shine and Promise. Those songs could have, really should have been included. And maybe they just didn't want to... This is technically their debut album, I guess, and maybe they didn't want to put out a 40-minute record, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good chance, too, that they just recorded these other songs later, too, and that was why they weren't included... I don't know. I don't know what the... They came out in 83, but I don't know what month they came out. So that may be the difference. Because if they recorded them first... This is recorded in August of 83. So, Shine and Promise. So, they recorded them after the full length. Yeah. So, okay.
They could have just still been kind of workshopping those songs and they weren't ready to release them, but...
I almost wonder then, maybe they shouldn't have rushed the album and then just
added
those songs on there. Did you listen to anything else they did later?
I didn't get around to it.
Me neither. So we didn't do our research.
I don't think that anything else they did is much better rated.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of all hover around the 3.3 to 3.5. So pretty average, I would say. And I didn't look into any of their... you know, the related stuff, Beastmaster Generals, or any of the other stuff that they went on to do, unfortunately. So I can't comment on those, but...
Yeah. Their second album has a higher score. It's got a 3.47. This album has a 3.34. And it's got 90 reviews, and this one has 112. So that one might be the better record. I mean, at least some people think it is. I maybe should have listened to it, but, you know, couldn't be bothered. remember, there's no useful information on this show, so. You know, I liked the drum work on this album as well. I noticed there was a lot of tribal elements, sort of like we noticed on the Flesh for Lulu EP. And then there's also the more mechanical kind of industrial drumming on here. The guitar work is good. Like, it ranges from the gothy Cure style guitars to like the bigger, crunchier riffs. I think he's a good vocalist. You know, overall, and the bass work is really good. So they're really good musicians. It is slightly disappointing that they didn't do better. But again, I guess it's timing, luck, record labels, you know, the right promotion behind it, the scene you've come from.
Yeah. I mean, they had, in that interview that I read with them, which is from Artificial Life Zine number 12, in case you feel like looking it up, you're not going to find much information on it. It's just collected somewhere on the internet. They were very fixated on money.
Really?
It really comes across that way in this article. I mean, they talked about having some disappointing turnout shows. They don't seem very DIY for a band that went and started their own label. And I don't know. They didn't. I think they just kept expecting to have someone come and offer them $50,000, you know, offer them big money. And it was, I don't know. They didn't have a sound that was going to be that commercially successful. I don't know. It's just, there are a lot of things that are going to work against you. And I think probably rejecting that goth label and being, maybe they would have had more of a scene and a better following if they had leaned more into it, accepted it. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, we see this a lot with bands that kind of reject the label that gets thrown on them. Like the Cramps didn't like being called a psychobilly band, and how many shoegaze bands hated being called a shoegaze band, you know? So,
I mean, on the one hand, I do get it when mm-hmm. you're doing something that doesn't, like, maybe you have some influences that are outside of that sound and you don't want to be typecast or whatever. But I do think in this particular case, they could have taken a step back and listened to this music a little more objectively, because it sounds like gothic music.
Yeah, it really does.
So,
I mean, what do they...
If that's not what you wanted to sound like, then there were some major changes you needed to make to your sound, and I don't think that they did.
No. So. Yeah, I don't know what did they think of themselves? Is it just like a post-punk band? Which, yeah, post-punk has a lot of gothic elements to it, though. I mean, goth is born straight out of post-punk. So, I don't know. It's just whenever... It reminds me of when a band is like, we're just like, you know, a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
It's like, come on. You're not just a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
Are you playing in the 50s and 60s? No. You sound like Bill Haley? No. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, you can argue about subgenres, classifications, and I don't know.
If you were in our text threads, you'd see that that's what we talk about quite a bit.
Yeah.
So many texts of going, ah, what? Why are they not classified as punk?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a music nerds don't want to pretend, or they don't want to admit liking punk music past like 1980. Like anything after that is something else.
Yeah. Well,
so there's a lot of stuff that gets labeled alternative rock or indie rock that it's punk.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a punk beat. It's got loud guitars. It's punk.
Yeah. I mean, I think 90s post-punk, 90s pop-punk flavored what everyone thinks punk is and kind of forgets that you can have varying levels of it. And they love to claim, I don't know, they love to claim Husker Du, but they, you know, Husker Du were very much a punk band. But then they don't want to claim any, like, 90s alternative or indie rock as punk because they weren't playing Warped Tour. I don't know. Or, you know, didn't have skateboard ramps on their music videos, or I don't know. I don't know what their issue with punk is. We got off on a tangent.
Yeah, well, look, do you have any other burning thoughts on Play Dead?
No. We talked about last week, this record came out in 1983, and we talked about other albums that came out in 83. But in case you didn't listen to that one, some of the bigger releases in gothic rock in 83 would be like Cocteau Twins, Baja, Sisters of Mercy, 45 Graves, Sleep in Safety, which we've talked about before, and Alien Sex Fiend. I guess those are like essentially like the biggest ones.
Well, and look at post-punk too. I mean, you have Power, Corruption, and Lies by New Order. You have Script of the Bridge by the Chameleons. You know, there's better stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, New Order is a weird band, because you very easily could lump them in with goth, but for some reason they don't really. I don't know. Is there something that sets a goth band apart from a post-punk band, besides imagery and lyrics?
Not a ton.
At least at this point.
There's something to the sound that I can't quite put my finger on. More probably, more in the vocals, I guess. Maybe more of an affected, mopey delivery. Mm-hmm. Whereas post-punk, you might lean more towards just kind of like a staccato shout, you know?
Yeah. A little bit more theatrical, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, looking at post-punk, you're right. You do see, like, if you look at the sub-genres of some of these post-punk bands, the Chameleons are listed as gothic rock. Echo and the Bunnymen, Killing Joke. Yeah. Interesting. I wouldn't be opposed to talking about those bands as well. I wish... Yeah, that's the problem with using radio music, though, is we'd lose some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say about this record, and so you want to rate it?
Sure.
I'm going to give it a 3.75. I think that's the highest we've rated anything in this month for Halloween stuff. So some of the songs, especially the B-side, are just a little too long and repetitive and not different enough. I think if you would have restructured it, it could have helped a little bit. Or maybe taken those bonus tracks and actually include them on the album. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. 3.75.
Yeah. I'm at probably like a 3.5. Not like I enjoyed it. I enjoyed listening to it both times. I'm probably not going to revisit it after this. So
yeah, I might throw the song Time on a playlist and
yeah, I maybe that. Yeah, but it didn't make it onto a playlist so far. So.
I think I like the album cover more than the actual record.
Yeah, I did too. It's a great album cover.
It really is. And if you don't know what it looks like, if you don't want to look it up, on our Instagram, we always post the album artwork. So if you're not following us there, go give us a follow. Doing a weird plug in the middle, but... All right, you ready to move on to our EP?
Yes.
Sure. So we got number 52 on the EP charts, and it is Dead or Alive, and It's Been Hours Now.
We'll be right back.
Dead or Alive, formed in 1980 in Liverpool, England. Released February 1982 on Black Eyes Records, which I believe is their own record label, because the only other release I found under that name is another Dead or Alive single. This EP is one of a series of singles prior to their first full-length album in 1984. And the personnel on this record is Pete Burns on vocals, Wayne Hussey on guitars, Mike Percy on bass, Joe Musker on drums, and Martin Healy on keys. The record was produced by the band. And Ryan Hussey also played in The Mission and Sisters of Mercy. And if you're not familiar with the name Dead or Alive...
That's the guy with the glasses in the top right on the album cover. I was like, he's rocking the Sisters of Mercy look.
Well, it's because he went and played in it.
It's him.
If you're not familiar with Dead or Alive, you are most likely aware of their most famous single, You Spin Me Round, parentheses, like a record. Huge 80s single.
Yeah.
And then even more so, Pete Burns would also be known for being on Celebrity Big Brother and a lot of other reality TV shows. So if you ever, in like the 2000s, he became a pretty famous character on those reality shows. Pete Burns passed away, what, 2 years ago? 2 or 3 years ago? Yeah, 2016, October 23rd, actually. So that'll be a couple of days from when we're recording this. Yeah, so like, would you call Dead or Alive a one-hit wonder?
Most people only know that song. I know they had other hits.
Yeah, I guess...
I have heard other songs by them on the radio and Shazammed them. Because I was like, who is this?
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, huh, weird. I'm blanking on their other... There's one other song that I know that still gets somewhat... regular radio play, you know, probably in like an 80s block, you know, but
there's a song called In Too Deep from 85, no Lover Come Back to Me from 85, which is probably the second highest charting single. It's off the same album as Spin Me Around, probably most of those singles. And then there's Something in My House in 97 was pretty high. Yeah, so they probably did better than what we know today in 2019. So they probably don't technically classify as a one-hit wonder, but it's their only gold single, so nothing else they really got that high. Yeah. So, yeah, what makes a one-hit wonder is, you know, up for debate.
Yeah.
Is it literally the chart, or is it more the memory of a band? But it's funny, because I would have never, ever considered Dead or Alive a goth band, because... they're mainly known for more like dancey pop music, like more new wave inspired stuff. They're part of the high energy subgenre, which is like another dance genre. A lot of their stuff has been remixed into just dance singles.
Yeah.
So it's weird to even call them a goth band.
I mean, they had a very goth image well into their dancey, you know, pop stuff. Mad Bad and Dangerous to Know just looks like a straight up goth rock record. So
yeah, and you know, he styled his hair very similarly to Robert Smith from The Cure. He wore that eye patch all the time. It's not... Actually, Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know looks exactly like the Damned's Phantasmagoria album cover.
Yeah.
Same white border. The Pete Burns is placed exactly in the same spot as the woman on the Damned album cover. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, but they're kind of... that album is really more called a synth pop, dance pop record, so... it's interesting. They definitely took... I mean, they do have the word Dead in their name, too, so that tends to be... another like adding to the image, the darker image that they carried.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we, I mean, we talked about this a little bit with Flesh for Lulu. Like, dance mixes of goth rock songs were pretty common in the 80s. And I mean, you know, goth rock, I mean, it plays into club culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the music that you listen to in the club when you're wearing all black and vampire makeup, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of gothic imagery in dance music, like, or in industrial, which is, like, bridging the gap between electronic and goth, has a lot of really dark imagery, too.
Yeah, I mean, cyber goth and et cetera. I mean, yeah, so it makes sense for Dead or Alive to start where they did and to wind up where they did.
I mean, they formed in 1980 as well, same year as Play Dead. So they would have come out of the same scene, and that's just kind of what the scene was doing at the time. Everything was very Joy Division, Cure influenced. They had a couple singles before this record came out, so I'm curious if those early singles are also as gothy. So there's a good chance they are. What did you think of this EP?
I liked the B-side songs more than the title track. It's Been Hours Now was an alright song. It didn't do a ton for me, but I really dug Whirlpool. I mean, Nowhere to Nowhere was pretty enjoyable.
That one kind of really reminded me of an Adamant song, because it had, like, the acoustic guitars in there. Yeah. And there's even, like, whip sound effects. And I was like, oh, yeah. Somebody was playing around with the the Adamant presets.
Yeah. Which.
Man, Adamant pops up a lot when we are talking about other bands. Was Adamant as big of a deal?
I mean,
in the 80s?
Our dad was listening to Adamant.
Yeah.
And Joan Jett, you know, so he crossed over.
Yeah. I know a lot of people considered him a punk band at the time, and looking at it now, I wouldn't say that Adam and the Ants was a punk band. Yeah. Maybe post-punk.
Yeah, like Dirk Wears White Socks. Mm-hmm. The very early stuff, but yeah, not ant music, you know.
Yeah. I don't know if that's just because of what we grew up listening to, and that's what our brain is, like, recalling, but... I actually really preferred the remixed version of It's Been Hours Now on the B-side. It's got more reverb on it. It makes it a little gothier and a little spookier. So, I prefer that version. But there's only four tracks on here, and one of them is the remix. So it's that thing where it's not, is this really an EP, or is this just an extended single, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's always such a weird classification, and yeah, the history of the EP, the extended play, I don't know. It's a very convoluted thing. Generally, it just refers to anything that's longer than a single.
Which is two songs, typically.
And not quite an LP.
Yeah. There's usually a time limit associated, or a number of tracks that tends to make it.
Yeah, typically anything more than six tracks.
Yeah.
More than 20 minutes. But, you know, some full-length punk albums are 20 minutes long.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's...
But then they're usually, like, short songs. You know, there's, like, 10 of them. But this EP in particular, and the Flesh for Lulu EP that we talked about, they kind of straddle that line between, like, EP and maxi single.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like when you start including remixes, you know, the same song multiple times on an EP,
mm-hmm.
and that's where it's like, I don't know, that's a little... it's more like a... Yeah, an extended single.
Yeah, I mean, it's what they... I mean, there is such a thing called as 12-inch singles. So, yeah. To me, an EP, like a true EP, was recorded all together and meant to be released together as a single release, you know?
Yeah.
Not just like, here's a sampling of tracks on an album. Which I do think is what this was. They didn't put out a full length until 84. So it essentially was them, like, we wrote three songs we really like and remixed one, so let's just throw it on a 12-inch. Because there's still a couple more singles before the first full-length comes out. So this was definitely designed more to get eyes on the band, I think, by releasing this, I assume, under their own label. And then the very next thing they put out is on Epic Records, so which they released a majority of their albums. So this was just more of a, we got songs, you guys should listen to them. And it worked. I mean, they were one of the biggest 80s hits, you know, of the decade. So they bet on themselves. I don't know how much of the lineup stayed the same throughout the whole band. I didn't look too hard. Looks like Joe Musker was out by 82. And Wayne Hussey was out by 83. And Martin Healy. Wow. So Michael Percy looks like he stays through to 89.
I mean, Mike Percy wrote a lot of their songs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, Mike and Pete were probably the real driving forces of the band.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they stayed through to the end. But when did Wayne...
I need to look at the... wonder if Wikipedia has one of those member charts.
Oh, wow. He was in The Mission, too. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that might explain the goth sound on this EP more. And then once he left the band, then they stopped.
Yeah, true. Because, I mean, 85 is the first full-length from Sisters of Mercy. They released an EP in 83. The Mission started, what, 85?
Wayne was in the band until 84. It says Steve Coy was in the band from 82 to 2016, so... I don't think he's on this. He's not on this record, so he joined right after. Yeah, and it's probably not.
And Wayne Hussey actually didn't even join Sisters of Mercy until after they had been a band.
Oh yeah,
he joined in '84, so he wasn't even on their first EP or their first singles, which they had singles way back to '80.
Yeah,
as well. I mean, his era of Sisters of Mercy is what people think of when they think of Sisters of Mercy. So,
is he on the one with Liz Corrosion and Lucretia? He's on the one with Black Planet. No, he's not. He's not even on the big one. He's not on Floodland.
Really? Huh.
So he's on the one that kind of like laid the groundwork for what they would become.
That's weird.
But he's not on Floodland, which is the huge.
So that's record. Not him.
Somebody stole his glasses.
Yeah. I could have sworn it was him.
Yeah. And plus, I also wonder, too, how was it easy being in a band with Pete Burns? I mean, if you've seen any of those reality shows he was on, I don't know how much of that was just him playing up to the camera, but he is definitely an over-the-top personality that I could see...
He wore an eye patch.
I could see him grating on you after a while. I don't know how much of that was just him later in life, you know, or playing up for the television, but there are a lot of members in Dead or Alive over the years, and really only one or two that sustained membership for a long period of time. So, I mean, that's not unusual, too, in a band, especially one that gets really massive, so... Since this one came out in 82, I thought I would look at the charts for that year as well. And seeing as it's only the year before the last one, it's a lot of the same bands. The Cure's Pornography came out that year, which is a massive record.
Though not actually that good. Hot take.
Hot takes.
I listened to that one not too long ago, and it didn't do anything for me.
I like Pop Cure better than Early Cure. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a Christian Death record. There's a Susie and the Banshees record. A Kiss in the Dream House.
Yeah.
More Sisters of Mercy, Cocteau Twins, Bauhaus. Kind of the same people you see on these charts during this time. TSOL, our good buddies, TSOL. Beneath the Shadows is on here. Their 82 album. Which I think is my favorite TSOL album. I need to return to them and see if I still like that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a Killing Joke. I wonder what the post-punk
charts look like for that year, too, to see what overlap there is.
I guess fitting with our mood of the month, the Gun Club's Miami came out in 82. Birthday Party's Junkyard.
Yeah.
Bands we've talked about.
There's an Oingo Boingo record. There's The Church. They put out a record in 82, which, you know, that's a band that I'm surprised is not more associated with goth.
Yeah.
Because they're pretty gothy.
Yeah.
To my ears. I like The Church a lot, actually.
I don't think I'm that familiar with them. Do they have, what's their big?
Starfish is the big record. You have heard Under the Milky Way. It's one of their bigger songs. It was actually covered by Starflyer 59, so you've probably heard that version. Reptile, that's one of their other big singles. It's a really good one. They're a band I'm not super familiar with. I've just kind of been gathering a little bit here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I am surprised. I mean, they kind of get the subgenre tag of post-punk, but they tend to be more associated with jangle pop, which I don't know.
What is
people like to throw that term around?
Yeah, they do
on Rate Your Music, and it's a little bit of a stretch at times. But let's see what else. There's a Wall of Voodoo record in 82.
Yeah, it's, man, punk is weird. In like 80, between 80 and 83, anything that's not hardcore, like, what is it?
Strawberries by the Damned.
underrated record.
Was in 82. Forever Now by Psychedelic Furs was in 82 as well.
Yep. Mission of Burma versus Modern English. That's the big Modern English record, isn't it? Yeah, that's the one with Met With You on it.
Mm-hmm.
Good record. A lot of fall records.
Yeah.
And if you're listening, I've been listening to the fall. I've only done two so far all the way through, but I'm liking what I'm hearing. Yeah, it is a strange thing.
Creatures of the Night. I mean, come on.
What? Who? By Kiss?
Kiss.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Band we're not supposed to like. Gene Simmons is a bad dude.
I don't enjoy listening to their music as much anymore. So, thanks, Gene.
It's not Paul or Ace's fault.
So, Dead or Alive.
Yeah.
It's been hours now since we've started talking.
Not really.
No.
It's,
what would you rate this EP?
I would give it a 3.5. I enjoyed these songs. I think the first two tracks are really, Nowhere to Nowhere, I think, is really strong. It's Been Hours Now, I prefer the remix, but even the regular version I really, really enjoy. So, I thought Whirlpool was the weakest song, honestly. I forgot to mention, like, the star of this record is Pete Burns' voice. His voice is amazing. Like, very powerful, and it doesn't fall into the trappings of a lot of goth bands or post-punk bands at this time with, like, monotones and, you know, robotic sounding Ian Curtis style vocals. Like, he's a great singer. So,
yeah, I almost took it for granted that Pete's a great vocalist. But I didn't even feel like talking about it, but yeah, you're right. He's absolutely a great singer.
Yeah.
Can be moody, can be powerful, can be, you know, he doesn't do one thing. Mm-hmm. He has a really good range and he really excels at all of it. I mean, it all works.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely the star of this record. I mean, there's a reason why, I guess, he became such a big figure in the 80s new wave scene.
Yeah, I mean, and think about this, about their later stuff, you know, mm-hmm. their hits, their dance stuff.
Like, yeah, I mean, Spin Me Around has, like, I know that every single person knows that song so well that I'm sure you're playing it in your head right now as you think about it. And just thinking about, like, his vocal performance, it's a very dynamic performance. So it's like, man, he really was a great singer. Probably Dead or Alive are probably an underrated band. Maybe I should look at, let's see, what's their Rate Your Music for their other albums look like?
I mean, they're kind not, of average.
Yeah,
they're
not great ratings.
They don't have any bolded
yeah
records, but
this is actually, no, I'm not counting that 2007 thing that they've got on here, but it is their best rated thing on Rate Your Music as far as between albums and EPs. It has 3.66 out of 41 reviews. Most famous record is Youthquake, which has a 3.23 and 497 ratings. So, but what did you think? What would you rate this one?
I gave this one a 3.5 as well. Mm. It's, I think it probably loses points just for having two versions of the same song.
Yeah.
And two versions of what I felt like was maybe not the best track. So, yeah, 3.5.
Well, all right. Thus concludes our Halloween Spooktacular with a low-energy recap. We have now become the living dead. So, next week, we are not returning to format because we will be at Fest. And for Fest, if you remember last year, we're going to play a little game called Fest Lotto Pod, where we pick a band at random to go see at Fest. Specific purpose, we tend to lean towards bands we've never really listened to. So, that will be fun. Last year we did it with Corey and Lauren, and more than likely we'll do it again with them this year. I think it's the plan so far. So, unless something crazy happens and we can't, they should be back on with us, and we'll, we talked about what? Liquid Limbs last year? Was that their name? Liquid Limbs?
That's like the one thing I don't remember.
I remember the recording. I remember having fun doing it. I don't remember their music very well.
I remember their music.
You don't remember their name. That's the thing.
And
you don't
their presence. Yeah. Oh yeah. I just don't remember their name.
That was a lot of fun. So yeah, we'll be at Fest. Hey, if you're gonna be at Fest, come find us. I'm sure you could DM us on Twitter or message us on Instagram if you're at Fest and you listen to the show, which I guess you wouldn't be hearing this if you didn't listen to the show, but come see us. I got buttons. I'll give them to you for free. Yeah, we're going to go try and see all our friends and people we've had on the show this year. I'm really looking forward to it, and Fest is always great, so we'll have that up. And then next week, we'll tell you what we're talking about when we return to format. So,
yes. Finally.
Continue.
No more gimmicks for a little while.
Until we do a fun one that's a secret for now. But
we're always cooking up some goofy idea to try out on this show.
Yeah, and I think the one we've come up with next is, that's going to be an undertaking for sure.
Yeah.
So, continue to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at PunkLottoPod. We have an email. It's punklottopod@gmail.com. And our website is punklottopod.simplecast.fm. Give us a rating on iTunes. We got a 1-star review this week, and it sucked. old guys getting mad at our opinions on hardcore records.
Yep. Look, I'm just going to say it again. Soccer Mommy is 1,000 times better than Millions of Dead Cops. I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I lose punk cred.
Yeah.
For that, but that's okay. Yeah. I can afford to lose a little more. Fine. Anyway, please give us some ratings and reviews. It helps us out a lot.
Yeah.
Mostly emotionally.
Please validate us.
So, we are perfectly capable of doing this forever without anyone ever interacting with us. Like so many things we've done, but it helps to brighten our day.
Yeah. And it helps people find us, because I sure am tired of tagging the bands on Instagram and them commenting on the posts about it.
Yeah. Especially when we don't talk very favorably about them. Sorry.
We need to go apologize to Save Ends at Fest.
Yes.
All right. That'll be it for this week. Good night.
Sleep tight.
First, you rip it open. of the ketchup run, blood red. Then you pour a bone-chilling glass of Grain Belt beer. You've created your own Frankenstein.